Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and it looks like your fellow Hawkeye, Kari Lake, is getting stronger and stronger here in the close in that race for governor in Arizona. You know, Arizona, too, obviously the governor as a whole, because Doug Ducey's the Republican incumbent. But after what happened in 2020, a lot of concern. Arizona is going blue, and you've got a very competitive race for the Senate seat, Blake Masters versus Mark Kelly. That's close. But some of the recent polling I've seen is has Blake Masters within the margin of error at minimum.
Good.
And Kari Lake is up.
Oh, thank goodness.
And Katie Hobbs, who is the Secretary of State and the Dem nominee for governor. It's really interesting. Why are we talking about a governor's race in Arizona when we have governor's race here? Well, it's interesting to compare and contrast how some of these races are being run, how some of the candidates are approaching some of the issues that every candidate is dealing with to varying degrees at the state level, at their state level.
Not to interrupt, but also there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Illinoisans who have second homes in Arizona who actually lived there 6 months and one day, so their voting rights lie in Arizona and not in Illinois.
Right, that's another...
Kind of like a Florida thing, but it's true.
I mean, there's a lot of implications as you do compare and contrast. Of course, a third of Arizona's population is Latino, and we have a sizable Latino population here, not as big, but if there really is this Latino revolt against the Dems happening, if the margins the Dems have enjoyed among Latino voters is shrinking as fast as it appears to be, then that's certainly going to show up in Arizona.
And Kari Lake, she's from Iowa, one the youngest of nine, grew up on a farm, so she knows about farming. And she and I were in communication classes together for years. And I finally put two and two together, because then she went out to Arizona, and she was an anchor with John Hook, who I know, you know, the Fox station in Phoenix for 20
plus years. So you guys both went into broadcasting. Why is she the only one running for governor? Right?
She took a different path. But she said during, you know, during the Trump years, she realized, you know, I got to get out of this business and I need to help my fellow Arizonans. She's married to a Latino. She has two kids, 19 and 17. And she's, I just love her. She's a buster, you know, what
she
I mean? An onions buster with Kyung Lau from CNN when she saw her. And she said, oh, Kyung, where's your mask? You know, because she's been masked up and following her on the campaign trail. But she did this the other week at a campaign event, and I can't stop watching it.
The Republican Party is the party of the Latino. It is the party of family. It is the party of faith. It is the party of the American dream. That's what Latinos are about. My husband is Latino. My children are Latino. I'm just a gringo, okay? But hi, look at that sweet baby back there. She's waving.
I like you because you take care of babies.
I do. Okay, she's going to make me cry right now. Thank you. You know why? Because your life is so valuable. We can't wait to see what you do when you grow up.
I'm gonna be just like you.
Nicely staged.
Oh, my gosh. What a sweet, sweet, sweet baby. I do care about our families. Come here, honey. Come here.
What's your name?
My name's Liana.
Your name's Liana?
Mm-hmm.
And how old are you?
Six.
This is why, truly why I'm in this. My kids aren't little like this. Like, if I tried to hold my daughter right now, I'd probably fall to the ground. She's 19. My son is 18, and I had so many great opportunities here. I came to Arizona for an opportunity, and I just want to make sure that the little ones have opportunities. I'm nervous about where things are going, and I want to make sure that you have a great life, that you can do. You do have a great life. Okay. You got a mama? You got a nana? Awesome. All right, I'm going to let you go back to mama because my arms aren't this strong.
But she's personable. She cares. I love her. Her opponent is wretched. Her opponent is doing the Joe Biden campaigning from the basement.
Leona, how much were you paid? All right. So Katie Hobbs, she went on, and by the way, keep that clip about her addressing, her relationship with her family, which, right, is her husband and by definition her children, Latino. But just keep that response in mind for a moment. She was on Face the Nation over the weekend. She won't debate.
She won't. She will not have a gubernatorial debate, you guys. That is a huge, huge red flag.
I don't think I can't recall ever seeing this, especially for, a challenger, which effectively she is in Arizona. I know some people see her as the favorite. I don't think so. But she won't debate. And here's her explanation on Face the Nation. She'll go on national shows with friendly interrogators, but she won't debate for the voters in her state. They like to see candidates side by side a few times to measure them.
She is the Democratic nominee for governor, and she's also in Phoenix this morning. Secretary Hobbs, good morning. Welcome to Face the Nation. So your opponent said you don't want to debate. I'd like to ask you, are there any conditions under which you would agree to debate Carrie Lake so the voters of Arizona could hear from the two of you side by side and in real time?
Look, what I've been focused on is opportunities like this where they can see us back to back and hear directly from us about the issues that are important to Arizonans and how we would govern without a circus like she created during the GOP Republican primary. I have no desire to be a part of the spectacle that she's looking to create because that doesn't do any service to the voters of Arizona to hear from us where we stand on the issues and how we would govern.
Right. So here's why she actually doesn't want to debate. Here's Carrie Hobbs, Katie Hobbs, excuse me, Carrie Lake, Katie Hobbs. Here's Katie Hobbs at a Hispanic Chamber of Commerce forum in Phoenix.
Oh, boy.
Let me ask you, how has it impacted you personally? What have you learned, specifically learned from the Latino community?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't necessarily think about it that way in those terms. I think I really value my relationships across the board with different folks, and I learn all the time from people in my life. My sister-in-law, she is Latino, and her family. I love hanging out with them and practicing my Espanol un poquito. I learned so much from her family. But I think it's really hard to separate out Arizona and subtract Latino culture because it's so much a part of who we are as a state. Arizona wouldn't be Arizona without what the Latino community brings.
So there's not one specific lesson you could share with me, other than Espanol with you. It's one third of the state.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's many lessons. The emphasis on family values, hard work. Those are something that I value in my own life, and
Where did you find
that's,
that?
That's why you don't want to go toe to toe with Carrie Lake because it's not going to be pretty.
Carrie Lake would destroy her.
Katie Hobbs also on the abortion issue too, and Carrie Lake, unlike so many Republicans, ostensibly pro-life Republicans who are afraid to talk about it. Carrie Lake is not afraid to talk about it. And she's not afraid, more importantly, to turn it back on her opponent, who is pro-abort up till the delivery room, maybe beyond it, not afraid to turn it on her and put the position side by side and ask the voters who the extremist on the issue is. Because Major Garrett challenged Katie Hobbs to set a date, if she has one, any limitation on abortion. Because I don't know, for some reason, some pro-lifers in Illinois think that Illinois, the majority opinion is abortion on demand, all 9 months, taxpayer funded, which is the Pritzker position. And it's not. It's a super minority position.
Right. So a lot of what is it? 78% of Democrats want some restrictions on abortion.
Right.
But Pritzker's ignoring all that.
Ignoring? He repealed parental notification, which is as much a parental rights issue as it is about abortion, an invasive procedure on your minor daughter. So here's Katie Hobbs at least I give him credit for challenging her on the debate and on this issue on Face the Nation.
What would the Hobbs administration's weak limit be for abortion access? If it's not 15 weeks, what is it?
Look, abortion is a very personal decision that belongs between a woman and her doctor. The government and politicians don't belong in that decision. We need to let doctors perform the care that they are trained and take an oath to perform.
So if an Arizona voter were to conclude from your previous answer that you do not favor any specific weak limit on abortion, would they be correct?
I support leaving the decision between a woman and her doctor and leaving politicians entirely out of it.
That's all. So birth canal? Birth canal. I mean, it's Ralph Northam, abortion and the baby is not killed. Well, then we have a conversation once the baby's delivered. Conversation about what? Well, this is the position of Katie Hobbs. It's also the position of J.B. Pritzker. And I know the commercials about everybody who disagrees with this is an extremist, but of course that's the classic leftist projection. Now compare that answer from Katie Hobbs and, frankly, the answer that Darren Bailey gave at the debate last week to what you're getting from Carrie Lake on the issue in Arizona, in a swing state, in a race where she's up a little bit, Carrie Lake, but it's margin of error.
Deal.
Oh, it's not a done deal.
Tell me, abortion is effectively banned in the state right now. Tell me, is that something that you support?
I support saving as many lives as possible. And what I really want to know, and I've been waiting, I tune into you guys all the time, I want to know where Katie Hobbs stands, but I never hear you guys ask her that. I'm pro-life. My plan would be that every woman who walks into an abortion clinic know that there are options out there. They don't have to choose that.
Thank you.
There's families who would love to adopt a baby. And right now, the way it's been going, they go in and they only have one option.
That's it.
Nobody tells them that there's other options. We want to help our women. If they're afraid, we want to help them. We want to give women health care, and I want to help people. But I really challenge you, and I'm happy to get back to you on this, when you find out where Katie Hobbs stands, because let me tell you where she stands. She supports abortion right up until birth and after birth.
That's right.
She supports if a baby survives a botched abortion, that baby die on a cold metal tray. And none of you ever try to get her to talk about her stance. So get back to me after you do.
Thank you.
Tell her.
And that's what I love about her. She challenges the media, even if it was with something important like abortion, and even when it comes to masks.
Hi.
Nice to see you. Off CNN.
You don't have a mask on anymore. What's going on?
We're outside. Aww. Do you have a minute to chat?
Well, we're 6 feet apart.
Do you have a minute to chat?
I'll do an interview.
Okay.
As long as it airs on CNN Plus. Does that still exist? Yeah. I didn't think so, because the people don't like what you guys are peddling.
Exactly.
She's awesome.
So when she wins, remember these exchanges. And if there are candidates who were afraid to embrace who they say they were who lose, remember these exchanges. Oh, by the way, Katie Hobbs has another problem. They're very similar to Ralph Northam. These socialists and their yearbooks. The Daily Mail has uncovered yearbook photos that show Hobbs was a student leader while her high school held a slave day tradition. Them socialists and their yearbooks. Will be following the Katie Hobbs yearbook story just for our own prurient interest, because it's entertaining to me.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. On a recent Joe Rogan podcast, he sat down with Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner, not to be confused with Jan Hammer. Jan Hammer, the Miami Vice theme song, for example.
Yeah, I was really confused about the two, so thank you. So
Jan Wenner, Rolling Stone founder. It was an interesting discussion. And, you know, I'm not like a huge Rogan fan. I think he sort of learns while talking sometimes. So I don't really understand completely, and I know I've gotten a lot of blowback on this. That's okay. I'm just restating my position. Don't really understand completely the mass appeal, other than he gets a lot of good guests who do have some things to say. But when he ran into a disagreement with Mr. Wenner on whether or not the government should regulate the internet, his instincts, Rogan's I'm talking about, very good, very good. Maybe making this accessible to people who are otherwise inclined to defer to a person of status like the founder of Rolling Stone magazine. Oh, he's so cool. No, he's not. It turns out he's kind of a dope, as you find a lot with people who have status. They may have done one thing really well, or they do one thing really well. But when they get outside of their core competency, they are very incompetent. And that, it turns out to be the case with Jan Wenner when it comes to thinking through the implications of his promotion of government regulating the internet. Take a listen to this exchange.
Meant to regulate the internet?
Absolutely.
You trust the people that got us into the Iraq war under false pretenses to regulate the internet? Do you think that makes any sense?
Well, wait a minute. The people who got us into the Iraq war.
It's the government.
Was the politicians.
It's the government.
In the end, yes, it's the government. But who else is going to regulate?
But if they're going to be in power and they're regulating the internet, they're going to regulate the internet in a way that suits their best interests. Same way they do with the banking industry, the same way they do with the environment, the same way they do with energy, the same way they do with everything. What represents their interests? There's so you're talking about so much money involved in disseminating information in
and
a very particular way.
The richest companies in the world are, right now, are the internet companies are. Rich beyond belief.
Yeah, it's fat, but it's a disruptive thing that has never existed before. I think it exists, and I think where we're at is where we're at. I think we need to move forward collectively as a country with an ethic that respects truth and that appreciates opinions and reality and an understanding of things that's not necessarily possible with corporate interests involved in the dissemination of information.
But there's no way to do that except through the government. There's no way that you can do that except through the government. Human nature is not going to change.
But the government's not going to change either.
But the government is capable of change. Okay, look, the government regulates, for example, the food supply, or it can regulate, let's take the
food supply.
Yeah, that Department of Agriculture.
Why have they let glyphosate infestate all of our foods?
Let's say it was one thing.
Yeah, but that's a problem. That's the government
agree.
Regulating.
Well, then we better get better politicians in them to appoint better people. I mean, it's not, again, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Right.
Okay. So let's take the SEC or take the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates big pharma. On the one hand, we've got a very safe supply of drugs in this country. You know,
safe?
Their drugs are tested. You know, you don't get too many bad drugs, you know, prescribed drugs.
25% of all drugs approved by the FDA get recalled.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. It's an important topic because of so much discussion across the political spectrum on the government intervening to regulate either the big tech companies and to some extent in terms of their indemnification on content that is posted through their communication channels, Section 230 issue, and even more generally. Or, as Rogan was sort of intimating, the government outsources the regulation of the internet and of content on the internet to private interest, to corporate interest, the big tech companies. It's amazing the things that Jan Wenner says. Rogan is right about that. He's right in, he's going in the right direction, and he sort of instinctively gets it. Jan Wenner says two things that are mutually exclusive. Human nature isn't going to change. This is why we need the government. I'm sorry, Jan, who is the government composed of? Those same human beings who possess the same human nature that's not going to change? I mean, I agree with him. Man has fallen and human nature doesn't change that much. Individual people can, but human nature doesn't change. Right. And so the folly of the left, as nicely encapsulated by Wenner and as nicely observed by Ambrose Bierce back in the day, is this notion that private vice becomes public virtue. The person next to me, oh, I wouldn't trust him to do anything. The person next to me, that same person is elected to office. Oh, I wanted to put my life in his hands. How does that transformation happen? How does that metamorphosis happen? Where the guy next to you, you don't trust to watch your kids. But then as soon as he's elected to the legislature, you want to put your entire life in his hands. Well, that's what Wenner wants to do. That's, you know, they're the only people who can do it. Why? The human nature doesn't change, but the government can change? What does that even mean? There's no thought there. There's no logic that's been applied to this proposition by Wenner.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
This is a great tutorial. I'm glad that Rogan had this exchange. It's very good, and it prompts a lot more conversation like we're having. The other thing that he points to, maybe he doesn't maybe exactly know the phraseology for it, but the great economist James Buchanan won a Nobel Prize for his research in this area, public choice theory. He's talking when Rogan is talking about corporate interests exercising this control over the government that's supposed to regulate them. What he's talking about is agency capture. And that absolutely is a thing. That absolutely is a thing. Agencies that have regulatory responsibility over a particular sector get captured by the biggest players in the sector over which they have oversight. Happens. I mean, the examples are innumerable. And actually, he's right about the FDA, too. Oh, the FDA protects us from bad drugs coming to market. First of all, I mean, we've got a sixth of the population that is walking around in a daze because of this push for therapeutic drugs and the antidepressant boom. And now we find out that it's... That the people who are depressed, it's not based on chemical imbalances. Oh, my gosh. We talked about that study that came out a couple of weeks ago when it came out. So they had it all wrong, including all of the all of our betters, all of the oracles that ascend from the common folk to positions of authority and become all-knowing, which is the position of Wenner. It's ridiculous. It flies in the face of what we see to be true. And then it drives so the agency capture piece is a huge topic area. And Rogan is right. I mean, if you look at the numbers in terms of the number of drugs that are approved that the FDA ends up recalling, you know, it varies based on how you look at it and how you define it. But he's in the ballpark when he says a quarter of the drugs the FDA approves are recalled. He's in the ballpark. So, I mean, the things that he's interested in, he does know a little bit about, and that's great because he just pantsed Wenner in that exchange. And then you get into this, well, who is going to prevent us from being exposed to misinformation? Nobody. I thought that was the beauty of the internet. It was the Wild West. It was sans government commissars regulating people's speech. How you generate a consensus on an issue is how you generate a consensus on what the best product in any sector is. How do we know who builds the best mousetrap? I don't know. How do we know what the difference is between a Mercedes and a Yugo? Because of their marketing? Maybe in part. Because of the experience of probably the price signaling? Yeah, that has something to do with it. So Wenner comes from the position that everybody who's not in the government or who's not part of the, you know, media elite is a rube who can't process any information, who doesn't recognize a persuasive argument, a fact-based fact-based position when it's presented to them. And that's the arrogance of these know-nothing elites like Wenner. So what is the best way to arrive at truth? Is it for a few people to be the repositories of the truth? Like this is some sci-fi world we live in and we go up to the mountaintop to visit the oracle and find out what the truth is? Or is it the nasty, tumultuous interchange between people arguing about particular ideas and particular issues? And then you have some people that draw different conclusions about what's the best way to go policy-wise, what's the most moral position to take ethically. I mean, how do you develop a different competing schools of philosophy, competing schools of economic thought, competing schools of artistic expression? Through central planning? Through government regulation? To make sure there's no bad art? To make sure there's no bad philosophers out there? Or you allow ideas to compete in a free marketplace and people to make their own decisions about what they believe, what they like. To me, this is so basic, but we're so far from first principles in this country that you have to get back to the basics. And I think Joe Rogan just helped us do it. So good for him. David in Winnetka, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. So to speak on Joe Rogan just a little bit, I've been a follower of two of my favorite men in the world, Joe Rogan and Dan Proft.
No particular order, right?
Yeah, I go back with Joe for about, I don't know, 2006, let's say, and you about 4 months, but you grew on me fast. The appeal for Joe, I don't watch any other sports. Started when people started taking the knee and that and this and that, and I personally just found it disrespectful, and I don't hold it against anybody else, however they feel about it, whatever, but it's just for me. So UFC is my jam. Joe's just a really, he's just a down-to-earth regular guy that, you know, has a lot of conviction. He's really underdog. He might call a fight a little skew at times, you know, if he's got a favorite fighter. He might say something like, oh, did you see how he broke that guy's hand with his face? But he's just a regular good guy, and I don't know. It's just the appeal of just
I get it. Thanks for calling. Well, and that's fine. I mean, I like Joe Rogan on news radio. That's where I had my first exposure. And by the way, a great show, underrated sitcom. Phil Hartman, genius. So the Rogan thing was just you have this platform, and he just doesn't know enough for me. But that's me, and I'm an arrogant prig. So that's fine. Whatever. You know, I have my.
You're racist and homeless.
I have my failings as well. But Rogan has a lot to learn. And I think he would admit it to some extent, which that honesty is also refreshing. He doesn't pretend that he knows everything. Great. But I mean, when you start out as a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Right. But he grew on a lot of Americans, you know, during COVID.
Well, I know.
Because of his stance on big government and not having choices, you know, to decide whether or not to get vaccinated or wear a mask. I mean, the list goes on and on. And he was people's. And so is this radio station. I mean, we are their people's savior. Like, they're okay. We're not insane. We need to find people that think like us.
Well, look, I get it. I mean, I understand Joe Rogan's the number one podcaster on the planet. I get it. I understand his popularity. But that's fine. I mean, I don't just ascribe to somebody because they're popular. There's a lot of adults that are popular. Look at the Kardashians. What do I care what they have to say? But Rogan,
it's what they're wearing.
But Rogan is different. And so I just, you know, so Bernie Sanders supporter to present, man, I see some growth, and that's great. But this exchange with Wenner is really, this is something that people should be talking about, because it goes to this fundamental idea of what a free society is. And Rogan is on the right path, and Wenner, unsurprisingly, is not. Dave and Racine.
Good morning. One of the founding fathers, bear with me for not remembering, said that if government people were angels, we wouldn't need government. And if government were angels, we wouldn't need limits on it. So, you know, that's probably why, you know, we have to have the marketplace of ideas as opposed to just having a government agency controlling everything.
Yes. Thanks for the call, Dave. Appreciate it. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
So Jenner is, I think he was, it might have imbibed too many of the drugs that he was talking about or that he did. And he's kind of emblematic of the baby boomers who, you know, first it was fight the man, and then they became the man, and then they want the man to control everything.
Oh.
You know, as far as that baby boomer generation, that was the most dominant demographic in politics for the longest time. And then I just want to comment on Joe Rogan. I think he shows intellectual curiosity that a lot of people have.
I agree.
And that's what his appeal is, and he's growing. And I think that's why he's, you know, going to be an intellectual factor. And the more he sees, the more he realizes, hey, wait, all these guys are in it for themselves. He's a realist when it comes to that.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good observation. Thanks for the call, Kevin. I'll tell you, he's been two for two. The last two podcasts I've seen, at least, the one he had with the filmmaker from Illinois, where they took up the Safety Act.
Yep.
And he said of Illinois, if this goes into effect, we're fracked, which was a very good summation. And now this with Wenner, you know, all right. I mean, you know, he's sticking some landings. I concede the point. Craig, Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you're exactly right on this, because Rogan had some good instincts on this. That Wenner's a lying sack of crap. And it reminded me when you were taking on that liar and you had that exchange, and man, you tore that guy up, and how encouraging that was when you did that. And so this is a little more encouragement with Rogan taking the same path, getting this idiot on there and basically giving him a rough time. It's very good.
Thanks for the call, Craig. David in Lansing.
Hi, I agree that when you said Joe Rogan, part of his appeal is he has all these good guests on. That's about it. He's connected to UFC. I'm glad he has the guests on. He challenges them sometimes. He doesn't go fully, though, on most of them. And one of the big appeals is I'm related to two millennials, so I point out things like I'm not Joe Rogan, but, you know, I have two studies that connect pot smoking to stillbirths, or I have a few studies that connect pot smoking to higher violence, and they get real mad because one of the big appeals that's not talked about of Joe Rogan is he's a pot smoker. He does it on air, so millennials need a reason to smoke pot and act, you know, just turn into a zombie. So that's
well, thanks for the call, David. To his credit, he's out Alex Berenson on, our friend Alex Berenson on, to talk about the connection between marijuana and increased heavy marijuana use and increased incidence of psychosis. Alex Berenson, who first made his mark writing about that very thing as the move to legalize dope swept the nation. And then he moved on to COVID, of course. But the other thing that's good about Rogan and us, too, to the extent we can get it, he does a better job, is he'll bring on people who disagree with him and have ideas side by side and discussions that are point counterpoint. And we love to do that. We just can't get enough courageous them socialists in our region to join us. But
Cam Buckner was supposed to come on and to talk about the Safety Act and why he's, you know, pro, and he would not. No. All scheduled to come on and never dialed in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe he got drunk.
Oh.
Coming up at 6:06. Well, he has two DUIs.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. one's not enough.
Yeah. So it was good. He needs that Safety Act so that he can walk when he gets the next one. Same thing with Rick Pearson at the Tribune.
Oh.
Yeah. A lot of drunks are driving around in politics and media here.
There are Ubers and Lyfts now. So,
be careful on the roads.
Watch your children.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Compelled by a couple of postings I saw from small businesses to talk about inflation's impact on the producer side, on the business side. I mean, I understand that that translates to the consumer side and your pocketbook when it comes to food prices and gas prices and the like. But be interested to hear from small and medium-sized business owner operators about what's happening in their business, in their particular sector. Restaurants, retail food operations like bakeries. One bakery, why our prices have gone up, and they posted this on a whiteboard, all of the ingredients they use and the price they were paying.
Before and now.
I don't, you know, whatever volume they buy them in. January 21 to January 22 to July of 22. So, for example, flour, at whatever amount they buy it, was $12.19 January 21,
okay.
$19.97 January 22. Now it's $28.88. So, you know, that's about 133% increase in the last 18 months. So you understand, we use a lot of flour in our bakery. And so if the inputs are going up 133% and you know, other increases in that realm, then you understand why your scone or your Danish is a little bit more than it was a year and a half ago.
Blueberry muffin, yeah.
I mean, it's just,
that's a huge increase. And think, you know what? I love that the company did that to prove, just to show customers, this is real and this is our reality. And now we have to force our reality onto you, the consumer.
I mean, it really is. It's something, too. I mean, all these things that you don't think about that go into producing these delectables from your local bakery.
Did they list their eggs? Because egg prices are insane right now.
Cake flour, $15.13 January of 21, $19.06 January of 22, $26.21 July of 22.
I'm sure they've gone up since then, too, because it is October.
Salt, $10.47 January of 21, $13.38 January of 22,
and
July of 22, $14.64. So it's still a 40% increase, and that's on the lower end of the ingredients that have increased. You mentioned eggs, $40.92 January of 21. Remember, this is like whatever volume they're buying.
Right.
I don't know.
It's a bakery.
So $40.92 January of 21, $47.30 January of 22. Now $92.02. So that's a that's 125% increase in the last 18 months for eggs.
I drove to Indiana to try and find eggs under $3, and it was impossible.
Well, and you look at this, and you, so it's just a bakery. It's a simple, some sort of a simple eye pencil sort of discussion here. Salt, rainbow sprinkles, eggs, cake flour, fresh yeast, donut fry shortening, AP shortening, whatever that is, powdered sugar, granulated sugar, flour. And you see these increases, and I think salt is the smallest increase over the last 18 months at 40%.
Right. And there's from eggs for $40.92 to $92. That's, I mean, they have to pass the cost on to the consumer, else they're going to close their doors.
Well, the bakery is doing better at having a handle on what they're paying, and that's what they need to charge, than Swanson's Deli on the south side in Beverly. Swanson's Deli posted this sign in their store. To our loyal customers and friends, as we face constant vendor price increases due to supply shortages and product demand increases worldwide, we have removed the prices from all our menus. We apologize for this, as we just cannot keep up. We're happy to discuss the issues we're facing and answer any questions you have. Hopefully, with your understanding, we can get through this difficult time and return to normalcy in the future. Swanson's, your neighborhood deli. We cannot keep up with the price increases, so we've just given up
prices.
Putting prices on our menus.
Well, when Paul Vallis filled in for you a while ago, his family owned a, you know, a Greek restaurant back in the 80s when Jimmy Carter was president. They had to do the same thing. They had to they had to put, you know, just tape over the prices and then write in every day and then take the tape off and put a new masking tape and write in prices.
So how
it changed, it was that fluid of a situation.
So I asked this on Twitter yesterday, how are you liking your Dem socialist stagflation? How are you liking it? And then, you know, some of the trolls, inflation is worldwide, exclamation point. No, I know. I know inflation's worldwide.
Thank you for the update.
So let me connect dots for the brain dead, and please, those listening, please do the same within your circles where you have to deal with some of the undead walking around Chicagoland and the greater region. Right. So what you had, which is why inflation is worldwide in the West, and which is why it's sort of an endemic problem in the developing world, is because, now follow me here, you have central planners pursuing the same central planning policy, modern monetary theorists, they call themselves now. And since the different people, you know, they are different ethnicities, but they're pursuing the same public policies, guess what happens? They generate the same results to varying degrees. So you're right, it's worldwide, because the people in the rest of the West and those autocrats in the developing world whose countries are always fighting off inflation, you know, sometimes in the triple digits, sometimes in the quadruple digits, is because they are doing the same things that we have done here on a smaller scale. You see what I'm saying? The same reckless monetary and fiscal policy. Reckless fiscal policy, make up for it with the printing press. So, right, if you pursue the same policy, whether you're in Chicago or Springfield or London or Copenhagen or sub-Saharan Africa, you're going to produce the same results. Do we understand this? I'm so glad. It's everywhere, exclamation point. Right. Now, can you take one step back and look at what policies were pursued? See if you can identify any similarities, you deep thinkers on the left, knee-jerk defenders of the modern monetary theorists, which is a fancy word for socialists. Inflation is anywhere and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. but it's always accompanied by reckless fiscal policy, and so is the case in this country and this state. And by the way, the cheerleaders for the federal policies pursued are all the people in power in Illinois. So maybe you can't get immediately to Biden and remove him from office, but you got a lot of Biden proxies roaming around in Chicagoland and in the state house, don't you? Hey, Scott on the Kennedy, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, you guys, I just wanted to make a couple comments. I work for a 100-year-old family-owned grocery distributor on the south side of Chicago, and we have been hit with this inflation in so many ways I don't even know how to begin to tell you guys. You're talking about the cost of fuel, the cost of food, labor. I can't find order pickers. I mean, I'm in charge of all purchasing, and I get price increases from manufacturers and every week in the hundreds. And you're not talking about 50 cents here and 25 cents there. You're talking about 30% here, 40% there, and it's not slowing down. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's crazy what's going on. And the fact that – go ahead, Dan.
No, and so how does that – how does that impact, you know, what's the approach that your employer, this a distributor, what's your approach that the employer takes in working with the grocery stores you serve?
We pass on those price increases to the stores.
Right.
And those stores, evidently, obviously, they pass on those increases to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this for 30 years. I'm not a millennial tech in my basement. I'm on my way to work right now.
Mm-hmm.
I see it every day. I don't know how people afford to feed their families.
I know. Honestly. That's exactly what every time I go to the grocery store, I'm like, how are people affording this?
And
you got to cut back on something every family has.
What's the discussion like with your employer about any sense of you know, the Swanson's Deli comment, when we return to normalcy, any sense of when something approximating normalcy, when you're going to see some relief? Do you guys have any perspective?
There's no normalcy in the grocery business. And only when you're dealing with commodities, things like eggs, milk, grains, those things fluctuate all the time. But
sure.
when you're talking about just regular product that's not a commodity, those prices never come down. I've never seen it in my career. I've never seen it. They'll throw some deals out now and then, but the list cost of product, you won't see them come down. This is the new normalcy.
Thanks for the call, Scott. Appreciate it. Good perspective. Well, okay. Jerry Northlake.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I'd just like to expand on your comment about that deli or whatever that had to take the prices down because they couldn't keep up with the cost of everything. There's a restaurant in Edison Park, and there's another one in Rosemont that add a 3% surcharge to the check because the company can't afford to print new menus with the new prices on there. So they ask the customers to absorb the cost of inflation by adding a 3% surcharge to the checks.
Well, that's interesting.
Which I don't mind paying. It's only a couple bucks, but still.
Yeah, it's telling. Exactly. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jerry. Carl, Southern Indiana.
Hey, this price increase is killing me. I've had to switch from Tito's and vodka to vodka and vodka. And Amy, I love you, Amy, but I have to make a point here.
What?
The reality thing, there's our reality, my reality, and your reality. No. Don't give the left that goofy fairy tale talking line. There's one reality, and we're all living in Biden's world.
Thanks for the call, Carl.
Yeah, but the politicians aren't living in Biden's world. They don't have to. I mean, when's the last time Biden gassed up or went to the grocery store, or Pritzker, for that matter? They're not suffering.
Well, that's part of the world. That's part of the reality of the world, that we're not all in the same boat, are we? We never were. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I wanted to comment that the prices at
for building materials like at Menards and even the local place over here, which is right down the street from Swanson's Deli. There's no prices on the shelves. When you go for wood, there's just codes, and you have to go in and you have to ask them what they're charging on a daily basis. That Swanson's Deli, we used to go there after Caddy and at Ridge when we were teenagers. That place had been there for 50 years on 103rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to hear that they're having that kind of a hard time. It's just a local corner joint, Dan.
Yeah.
Local corner joint.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tom. Tom in Oswego.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. I've called in before regarding this stuff. I've been a contractor for 33 years, 62, father of three. The cost increases that people don't see, they hear about the food prices. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm a roofing contractor. I do commercial buildings. They don't hear about the price increases we're incurring. And it's very difficult for me to pass it along. For instance, I put a bid out tomorrow. They accept it 6 months from now. How do I keep readjusting my bid when I'm getting price increases every 2 weeks? And some of these price increases aren't, you know, 6% or 8% like the inflation shows. No, it's 20, 30, 50%. I've had price increases in the last year of most of the materials we use double and triple. And when President Biden goes on TV and says, oh, inflation only went up an inch, I'd love to pull an Elvis and shoot my television. Not him, but shoot my television and say, listen, it's gone up 5 inches for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're talking about, 1 inch. And it's gotten very difficult. And another phase of this, Dan, is in construction. What's going to start happening, I see it now, the influx of illegal immigrants is now starting to saturate the construction industry. So it's dragging the prices down, the cost. At the same time, ours are going up. So us guys who are doing it legitimately have to work twice as hard, try to find some type of competitive edge to compete. And it's getting harder and harder. Now, I'm 62. My wife retired. I'm very close to just hanging it up and saying, you know what, I can't do this anymore and still make money and work 80 hours a week. And so this, when you see inflation, you know, on the televisions, 8.2 or what have you, that's a very limited amount of things they're calculating.
That's right.
The real world out here, I wish somebody would drive with guys like myself for about a month, you know, some of these politicians. Mm-hmm. You want to see what it's like out here? I'll tell you what, it's getting to be dog eat dog. And it's going to get worse because, again, as inflation rises, prices go up. My buyers, the people who buy my service, they're going to look for people who are going doing more things underground. Either I have more offers for cash this year than I've ever had. People, if I pay you cash, can you do it cheaper? And I say, well, no, because I still have to declare the cash.
Right.
I can't hide it.
Right.
So it's gotten it's just exponentially harder this year.
Thanks for the call.
I pray for all those food service people. I have a lot of friends in the restaurant business. Honestly, I don't know how they're doing it.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. Another one in the restaurant business, Karen and Beecher.
Oh, good morning, my dears. I kind of really sort of don't care right now about what's going on in the rest of the world because we are spinning our wheels in the mud of Pritzker and Biden. And when people come to me and complain to me about, oh, my God, the hamburger went up 25 cents, whatever, I say to them, let me tell you something. My husband, he is the end of the line, the end of the line. He has always paid his employees above minimum wage because he wants to retain them. So he's always above and beyond whatever governor has mandated. So now he has that cost, but then he's got the mandated costs of the minimum wage of all of his purveyors, all of his suppliers. Then they started adding transportation costs to him, which we kind of sort of get, but that's really not fair because he's at the end of the line again. So he's got to absorb that. Then he's got to absorb all the cost of the charges for the credit card companies. And don't even start me on the liquor industry with Wirtz and Jesse Jackson, the stranglehold that they have put on the liquor industry, it's just awful. And we're going to now probably have to pass on the cost of the credit card use to all of our customers, because we can't keep handing out $7,000-$8,000 a month on these transactions.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Thanks for the call, Karen. Well, appreciate it. Sure.
Interest rates went up.
Well, and right, cutting
right.
Yeah, they, right. Yeah. You're going to have to.
Got to get the cut.
You can't afford to give away any points at this point. Nick and Mantino.
Hey, how you doing, Dan and Amy? I have a family of seven. We're a Catholic family. Our grocery bill used to be right around $350. Now we're looking at anywhere between $650 to $700 a week with this increase. And a lot of people tell me, they're like, oh, well, it's more of a liberal thing, or it's not a Democratic thing. But the liberals and the Democrats, they all vote lock and step with each other. So I blame every single Democrat out there. They all vote together. They all stay together. They are all responsible for this. It's not just a Joe Biden thing. This is a Democratic thing across the nation, whether it be Pritzker, so on and so forth. It's a Democratic problem that we have right now. Obviously, their stuff does not work.
Amen to that, Nick. Thanks for the call.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Tickets are on sale now for Freedom Summit 2022. Get yours today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. David Brooks writing in the New York Times. They're struggling in the classroom. American girls are 14 percentage points more likely to be school ready than boys at age 5. By high school, 2/3 of the students in the top 10% of the class ranked by GPA are girls, while roughly 2/3 of the students in the lowest decile are boys. In 2020, at the 16 top American law schools, not a single one of the flagship law reviews had a man as an editor-in-chief. Men are struggling in the workplace. 1 in 3 American men with only a high school diploma, that's 10 million men, now out of the labor force. It's the biggest drop in employment among young men aged 25 to 34. Men who entered the workforce in 1983 will earn about 10% less in real terms in their lifetimes than those who started a generation earlier. Over the same period, women's lifetime earnings have increased 33%. Michelle Goldberg's a piece on the same topic. Boys and men are in crisis because society is. Does she have that reversed? Well, to answer that question, we're pleased to be joined by Richard Reeves, senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, where he directs the Boys and Men Project and holds the John C. and Nancy D. Whitehead Chair. His new book of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It, was the subject of that David Brooks column in part that I was referencing. And he joins us now. Richard Reeves, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
So boys and men are in crisis because society is. Is it a chicken and egg argument, or does Michelle Goldberg have it in full reverse? Society's in crisis because boys and men are.
Yeah, I think Michelle's telling half the story, which is that there are a lot of problems in society now, including the loss of many traditionally male jobs and including dramatic changes in the family and in education, all of which are impacting boys and men. But on the other hand, if men are struggling, if boys are struggling at school and men are struggling in the labor market and fathers are struggling to find a place in the family, obviously that has negative effects for society. And I think what we're seeing here is actually something of a vicious circle. Whereas boys are struggling in school, they then grow up to struggle in the labor market, which makes it hard for them perhaps to fulfill the role in the family they want to, which affects their children. And it turns out, especially affects boys. And so they then struggle at school. And so the cycle turns. And so I don't think it's that productive, really, to look at only one side of the causal arrow. It seems to me that both are true, that because boys and men are struggling, society is not in great shape. But the opposite is also true.
What kind of work opportunities are not available for men anymore?
In traditionally male jobs such as manufacturing, so the share of manufacturing as a proportion of the economy has dropped dramatically in the last few decades. There are some other jobs such as mining, steelwork, etc. The ones you would think of as being traditionally male, and you wouldn't be wrong to think of that, just statistically they were dominated by men, and especially men who perhaps didn't actually have to have particularly high levels of education to do those jobs. So those jobs have very, very quickly declined over recent decades, so quickly for an economist, I should say, over the last few decades, partly as a result of automation, of machines coming in to do the jobs that were previously done by men, and partly because of greater competition from overseas. Now, it's not to say those trends are bad things, that globalization and automation are bad in themselves. It is to say that they've disproportionately affected male jobs.
Well, sure. And so, per Joe Biden, his message to West Virginia coal miners, learn to code. Go to your community college and take a class and learn to code and get with the new economy.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I think that's sometimes been a message from politicians across the board. And I think there's a couple of problems here. On one side, you get what I would say is a sort of naivety, which is to just expect people who've done one kind of job like mining to pick up another job like coding. And the truth is, of course, that there are lots of jobs in between. There are lots of jobs we need, like in our healthcare sector and education and transport, lots of need for truck drivers, et cetera. So, and in retail, now they're not coal mining for sure, but there are more jobs growing in those areas. But I will say, I think sometimes there's a problem too, which is the politicians give the impression that they can wave a magic wand and against the economic trends somehow bring back jobs that are economically becoming harder to sustain. It's not that we wouldn't support those jobs. In fact, the bipartisan infrastructure bill will absolutely help manufacturing and construction to some extent. But there are lots of politicians with false promises as well.
Mm,
it's worth
no
bearing
question.
In mind. The number of coal mining jobs actually declined between 2016 and 2020 during Donald Trump's presidency. And that wasn't because President Trump didn't care about coal mining. It is because presidents don't have magic wands that can change the economy.
No question about that. That's absolutely a fair observation. I want to go back to the education piece. So let's get to boys, in the formative years as they're entering school and then making their way through school, whatever level they achieve. So how do you describe the 180 that's happened, particularly at the collegiate level, in terms of who earns bachelor's degrees and who earns master's degrees in almost every subject, at what percentages in almost every subject, except for computer science and a couple of hard science disciplines, and so what have you seen, or how do you diagnose what's happened in pre-K through post-secondary education and the impact it's had?
Well, what we've seen is that girls and women have not just caught up with boys and men in education, but they've blown right past them. They've overtaken them, and they're now leaving them in the dust. And that's true actually at every level of education. So you've already cited some of the statistics, at the beginning of school and at the end of high school. But perhaps the most dramatic, or maybe the most obvious shift, has been in higher education. So 50 years ago in 1972, when Title IX was passed, which was a federal law to help women and girls in college, a big legislative effort. At that point, men were 13 percentage points more likely to get a four-year college degree than women. Now, women are 15 percentage points more likely than men to get a four-year college degree. So gender inequality in higher education is wider today than it was 50 years ago. It's just the other way around. And
why
nobody
is
predicted
that?
Nobody.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what a lot of economists and sociologists are spending their career trying to figure out. My own view is that it seems pretty clear to me the education system actually is structured to favor girls and women. It rewards certain skills, paying attention, sitting still, organization, but on average are stronger in girls, but particularly they develop earlier in girls. Girls, actually, a 16-year-old girl, her brain, this is neuroscience, has actually just developed a bit more quickly than boys, especially in the areas of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that are the bits of the brain that make you do your chemistry homework rather than go out and party, the bits that care about your GPA, the bits that turn in your homework on time. And any parent of girls and boys is never shocked to learn that there's this difference. It's what people say, it's like, well, duh, thanks for that research study showing me what I already knew. But then that's playing out in university and college in a way that it wasn't before, because girls weren't encouraged to go to college. Now, if anything, girls probably encourage more than boys to go to college. And so we couldn't see the natural advantages they had in the education system because they weren't, because we had the brakes on. As soon as we took the brakes off girls and women, they blew right past the boys. And so there are structural inequalities. It's not that boys overnight became lazy and disorganized and sloppy. It's not that there's a tendency to blame the boys, right? Why can't you be more like your sister? A parent might cry. But it's not their fault, by and large. It's the education system doesn't suit them as well as it suits their sister.
Well, okay, and one of the things that you suggest is that the boys start school a little bit later than girls do when they're a little bit more mature. You think that would level some of the social, emotional development that occurs, yes?
Yeah, yeah. I think boys should be encouraged and allowed to start school a year later. Because they are developmentally behind girls, and now that we've leveled the playing field, if you like, we're seeing the natural advantages of girls. But for me, the main reason to do that is do it from the beginning. But the main advantages, I think, will flow 10 years later in adolescence, when the gap between girls and boys is at its greatest. But I think rather than make the boys repeat a grade, which does happen to a lot of boys, actually, especially black boys, one in four black boys have repeated a grade by the time they finish high school. It's a really pretty high percentage. Boys are more likely to repeat a grade. So that's just to start all the boys a year later by default, and then they'll be a year older. But developmentally, they'll just be about the same or closer to the same as the girls in the classroom with them.
Well, that stat about young black boys and repeating grades and the stats we know from test scores, from reading and math aptitude and so forth, it seems to me there's something else going on, too, that needs to be addressed. And the difference between the family structure across the racial spectrum 50 years ago as compared to today and what's happened during that time period. Maybe what's the situation at home, which has the greatest impact on a child's intellectual, social, emotional development, is much different than it was for boys who grew up when I did in the 70s and 80s and certainly previous generations.
Yeah, well, I think you're pointing to two things. One is that there are these huge race gaps in education generally. But there's an interesting difference, which is that there's a huge gender gap between black boys and black girls and between black men and black women. So all the gaps we're talking about here, they're bigger between black girls and black boys. In fact, young black women now are doing quite well at some measures of education. There are more young black women, for example, with a postgraduate degree than there are young white men. And there are twice as many black women with a college degree as there are black men. So those gender gaps are just amplified for black boys and men. But to address your question directly, it's quite clear that fathers matter to the development, to the educational development of kids, and especially of boys. So to the extent that there isn't a father involved, and the father doesn't have to be married to the mum to be involved, like I think that's pretty clear by now, then it does have a disproportionate effect on boys and sons in those households. So it's clear that boys are more affected by family instability, by family breakdown, and by poverty and by poor neighborhoods. But the last thing I'll say on that is that we shouldn't just think about this in terms of just the immediate family. There's excellent research, this is done by Raj Chetty's team, which shows that in neighborhoods where there are lots of black fathers, engaged black fathers, black boys in those areas do better in school, even if their own father is not around. So what that's telling us, I think, is that just having men around as role models, as members of the community, perhaps as coaches, etc., they're called social fathers sometimes in the literature. They matter as well, too. Yeah. But the takeaway should be that fathers really matter, whether they're married to or living with the mum or not. In fact, in some ways, especially if they're not married to or living with the mum. And I'm afraid that we haven't updated our views of fatherhood to meet the modern reality, a world where 40% of breadwinners now are women. And that's more than half of black families have a female breadwinner. And so we've got to update our view of the family.
He is Richard Reeves, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he directs the Boys and Men Project, the book of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. Richard Reeves, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, they've got enough to prosecute Hunter Biden. We all knew that, but now it seems like
the rest of the world is surprised now.
There's some admission from inside the Department of Justice and the FBI that that is indeed the case after much apparent effort by the FBI, particularly one agent who quietly retired named T-Bolt, to spike the Hunter Biden investigation. Now we're at a place where we're talking about a Hunter Biden prosecution. Of course, it's not for his high-flying corporate ventures in China or Ukraine, but for tax evasion. I mean, I guess indirectly related, tax evasion and lying on a federal firearm application. What would a prosecution of Hunter Biden look like? Where might it possibly go were it to happen? Well, let's explore that with someone who knows how these things go. He is Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
All right. So decipher what has been put into the public domain about Hunter Biden and the possibility of a prosecution to this point.
Well, I think what's recently been put into the public domain is stuff that we already knew about for a long time. And what ought to have people most angry about this is that even if it were true, which it's not, that the main importance of the investigation of Hunter Biden involved his tax matter, as he euphemistically calls it, and a false statement he made about a gun that he on a gun application when he purchased a gun. Some time back, that information has been out there for years.
Right.
The gun transaction, I think, happened in 2018, and they knew that a false statement was involved like within a week of its having been made, thereabouts. So that's 4 years ago. And the tax stuff has been out there for years. You know, there's been liens on Hunter Biden's properties for years. So even if we didn't know about all of the foreign money that went into the Biden family coffers, which obviously is the most important thing about the investigation, even if it were true that this was the Hunter Biden investigation rather than an inquiry into millions of dollars of foreign funding that went to the Biden family and in which the president is personally implicated, even if the case was what they pretend it is, the only notable thing at this point is that it's taken over 4 years and nothing has happened, even though it's a very straightforward case. This is not like rocket science. This is not one of the, complex Ponzi schemes of all time or something like that. These are very straightforward misadventures, which would have been easy to prove and in a normal case would have been proven long ago. So I don't think there's anything notable specifically with respect to Hunter Biden about all this, except for the fact that it's taken so long and the Justice Department should have acted by now and hasn't. You know, what really is notable is, what, as I've suggested, this is not really, the importance of this is not about Hunter Biden at all. And I think the likelihood of what's going to happen here is what I've been saying all along, which is that the Justice Department at some point when they figure people aren't paying too much attention will take a minor plea of some kind from Hunter, probably to, some settlement of his tax charges where if he hasn't, I think he's already borrowed money from someone to pay his outstanding liabilities, but like he'll have to settle that and maybe he'll make a false statements plea on the gun. They'll resolve it with little or no jail time, and the rest of the investigation will be swept under the rug. The Justice Department will run around and say, see, we were not afraid. We prosecuted the president's son. Biden will say, see, President Biden will say, see, I didn't interfere with this at all. And what will have been orchestrated is that the most important parts of the case will just go away.
I'm sure Shakira is hoping that she gets such a deal in Spain. But here's the thing about that, though. If he pleads out to income tax evasion, Then how does the Department of Justice explain not going after the big guy, Mr. 10%, for the same charge? Because he either reported income he received from Hunter Biden, who said, I pay all the bills, and that's income that the president should have reported, or he didn't, and he evaded taxes too.
Well, if he reported the income, you know, a lot of what happens, especially with people who have complicated finances, is they, you know, they leave it to lawyers and accountants to figure it all out. And if it turns out that he didn't conceal any income he may have gotten, but he accounted for it in funky ways, that's not necessarily going to be criminal.
No, but wait a second. But that's all accounted for. The money that Hunter gave me is all accounted for. Oh, okay, well, then you were lying when you said you didn't know anything about his business dealings because you're being compensated based on his business dealings. And I'm not saying that's criminal. But I'm saying that opens up a whole different conversation that should be of interest to the Department of Justice.
Well, I don't know. Does it? I mean, the Department of Justice is not in the, he lied to the public business. The question is, did he lie, on any official thing that you have to tell the truth on? Like, were you, you
provide
information?
But if you get kickbacks, wouldn't you have to pay taxes on that?
Well, it gets complicated, doesn't it, when it's a son and his father, right? And it looks like it seems to me that what happened here was the foreign money was treated like kind of a Biden family piggy bank.
Yeah, Biden Inc.
And his brother.
Right. And I think the money went various different ways. But it's not clear, Amy, that they didn't account for all of that. You know, part of what we have to remember here is that a lot of this income, like, for example, the worst to me is the CEFC transaction, because
yes.
I think CEFC was like it was an arm of the Chinese regime and the Chinese Communist Party, and it was being investigated by the Justice Department as a clandestine agent of China. That's what they were getting $6 million from. But that happened in 2017, 2018, when Biden was not in office. Hunter has preposterously said, my dad was out of office. Why would anyone pay for his political influence at that point?
Right.
Of course, everybody knew he was running for president at that point. But my point in pointing out these niggling, infuriating details is that it's not like he was in office making money from foreign entities. And if it turns out that they accounted for it, like they didn't hide the fact that the money came in from the IRS, it's sleazy, but it's not necessarily criminal.
It confirms something that has not been confirmed, and it opens up all of these avenues of inquiry. Like, okay, well, so if you were being paid by some of the money that was being generated for Hunter per his relationship to the oligarchs that control Burisma in Ukraine, and then you went to Ukraine and you had the prosecutor fired using public money as the leverage to have a prosecutor looking into Burisma fire, then how is that not influence peddling if you got paid to do it? If you received some residual benefit from Hunter's foreign dealings and then you used taxpayer money to leverage your private interests? Now we're starting to get to some interesting territory, wouldn't we be?
Well, I mean, if the facts were as you described them, I mean, I've looked closely at the Burisma transaction, and I think that, again, it's completely sleazy. And I should point out, by the way, that Ron Johnson and Chuck Grassley have done lengthy reports on all this. You know, what you're pointing out now, it's not like it hasn't been disclosed. It's just the media doesn't care about it, right? So that's why it hasn't been made into big news. But for example, on the Burisma thing, I think Biden was lying. I think he was trying to like beat his chest and suggest to people that he had a bigger role in the firing of that prosecutor than he actually did. I don't really think he had any role in it. I think actually Christine Lagarde, who withheld or threatened to withhold about, she was the head of the
World Bank,
International Monetary
IMF,
Fund.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, the IMF, right. She threatened to withhold like $40 billion of funding from Ukraine if they didn't fire that prosecutor. So I think Biden was trying to piggyback on her muscle flexing to try to pretend like he was a big, you know, tough guy.
Perhaps, but I still look at this and say, I mean, this is important politically and culturally in addition to legally. And so I still look at this and say, if we get confirmation that he paid taxes, let's say he didn't break the law, he paid taxes on the money he received from Hunter Biden, then he knew about Hunter Biden's business. He's a material participant in his business. So he's been lying, number one. Number two, you have to answer all sorts of questions about Ukraine and, as you say, about China and also CEFC as it pertains to what Tony Bobulinski has talked about. CEFC's play to buy a 14% stake in Rosneft, a Russian energy company. So you know, what exactly were your conversations? How exactly did Biden and Hunter and his partners, maybe including your brother, leverage these foreign interests to funnel cash to your family, including you? You get confirmation of it, and then, you know, it makes it a little bit more difficult for the media to ignore. Just like months, years later, it's a little bit more difficult for the media to ignore Hunter Biden than it was in the run-up to 2020.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. And I think that if this was not the media's favorite guy, he'd have been impeached over this, which is what was supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, what the framers were most worried about is an American president who was over a barrel from foreign regimes, particularly,
exactly,
you know, foreign regimes hostile to the United States. So if the government was working the way the government was supposed to be working, you wouldn't depend on the Justice Department for this stuff. You know, Congress would have impeached him by now. But obviously the government isn't working the way it's supposed to be working. So at least what you hope for is that you get disclosure of all the information. But here we have a situation where Ron Johnson and Chuck Grassley have actually done an extraordinary job exposing a lot of this stuff, and the media just doesn't care about it, doesn't get covered.
Yeah, yeah. All right, give us your take on where we stand weeks removed from the raid and the special master and the documents and the what was classified and what wasn't and things that Trump has said. And so where do things stand with the former president, in your view?
Oh, you mean the case that the media does care about?
Yes, that case,
yeah, that
the
one.
Other one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that's going to be prosecuted, I think. Well, I'm not sure it's going to be prosecuted, even though I think I've said from the beginning, you know, Trump could talk himself into being prosecuted by continuing to accuse them of, you know, planting evidence and calling their honor into question and all that stuff. Because when he runs off at the mouth like that, he strengthens the hand of people in the Justice Department who are working on this case and are dying to indict him over
right.
it. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that is the wild card in this case, which is probably unprecedented in our politics, like all kinds of stuff you could say about Trump, is that I think the Democrats really want to run against him. You know, and I think they think that Trump can win the nomination, the GOP nomination, but can't win a national election. And I think it'd be very hard for him to win the Republican nomination. I personally don't think he'll win the Republican nomination, but I acknowledge that he could. And I think it'd be very hard for him to win it if he were indicted. So I think they like him as a kind of a wounded, but nevertheless, still, as far as Republican politics is concerned, influential and dangerous person who could win the nomination. And then they figure they'll kill him in the general election. So I think the minute they don't think he's going to run, like if he starts to signal he's not going to run, then they'll indict him, because I think they already have a, especially on the classified documents, they already think they have a case ready to go. But I think their reason for not bringing it at this point is more political than legal.
You know, their reason for bringing or not bringing everything seems to be more political than legal.
Yep. There's a lot to be said for that. Yep.
Andy McCarthy, former chief U.S. attorney, Manhattan, contributing editor, National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, right-wing carnival barker at wirepoints.com.
He's another racist.
We'll get to that in a second. You've seen the ads that J.B. Pritzker is running touting how much better is the fiscal health of Illinois under his stewardship. We saw our bond rating improve.
From what? Junk? Negative junk? To
so bond rating improve, according to the rating agencies. Yeah, because of the temporary influx of $186 billion in funny money from the feds. Well, that goes away. And when that, when the water recedes, the flood of money recedes, then what's left on shore in Illinois? I'll tell you what's left on shore. Even with the modest upgrades by the rating agencies, Illinois still has the worst bond rating of any state in the nation.
Oh, why isn't that in his ad?
Yeah, gee, I wonder. So to repeat for your friends, since nobody pays attention to this, and they just, so many of Illinoisans just dutifully gobble up whatever Pritzker's serving. Illinois, under Pritzker, worst bond rating of any state in the nation, and it's not close. And by the way, it had sort of a big impact in terms of state finances, the health of the state, since he's taking a victory lap about Illinois' fiscal health, which is just an incredible thing to witness. But it speaks to the hubris of people like Pritzker, what they think they can get away with because people like him have been getting away with it for so long in Illinois. It's unfortunate. Had Jim Urio, our friend, Fox Business contributor, look up some Illinois versus Florida numbers. Illinois versus Florida. Illinois total debt, $62 billion. That's about $4,800 per capita. That's just bond debt.
That doesn't include, okay.
Unfunded pensions and so forth. Unfunded pension obligations as a percentage of state personal income?
Yeah.
Almost 20% in Illinois. Florida, by contrast, $29 billion. That's $1,300. $29 billion in bond debt. That's $1,300 per capita. So that is, about one-fourth.
Yeah.
Illinois is about 3.5x, let's call it, more debt per capita than Florida. The unfunded pension obligations as a percentage of personal income in Florida, 4%. So it's about 3.5x on the debt per capita. It's about 5x on the unfunded obligations as a percentage of state personal income. And boy, that's a big number. And where do you think they're going to come to fill that hole when it needs to be filled? Just some other rankings. Actually, one of the questioners in the debate last week mentioned this Chief Executive Magazine, Illinois 48th out of 50 in best versus worst state for business, according to a survey of CEOs. 48th, ahead of only New York and California. That's one ranking. Rich states, poor states, the ranking done by Art Laffer, Steve Moore, Larry Kudlow. Illinois is 45th in the U.S. for its economic outlook. Property taxes. Wallet Hub has Illinois 50th out of 51 because they include D.C. Only New Jersey has a higher effective real estate tax rate than Illinois, so that's 50. The Mercatus Center, their for fiscal ranking of states, Illinois is 50th. So 50th on fiscal health, Mercatus, 50th out of 51 in highest property taxes, so second highest in the nation, according to Wallet Hub. 45th in terms of economic outlook by rich states, poor states, those economists, and 48th, according to a survey of CEOs and best state to do business. But hey, everything's going well. It's great. Real turnaround artist, that Pritzker. Okay. Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.com. Thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. All I've got to say, Dan, is stop barking.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
You too, carnival barkers.
All right. So what's your response to Jelly Belly on the assertion that extremists over at Wirepoint are just carnival barkers, just making stuff up?
Well, yeah, you know, he says we're making stuff up, but, you know, you just reeled off a bunch of information that's coming from sources all over the country, you know, other credible sources who don't have a stake in Illinois. They're just ranking across states. And when you talk about the fiscal side, you know, what's sad about this is we've been saying this about Illinois since you ran for governor, and that's about the time I entered into the policy issues of Illinois. You know, we've been last. I would argue that, you know, Pritzker's helped that make it worse. Or he certainly perpetuated our problems. And, you know, he calls carnival barkers to anybody who's trying to tell the truth about Illinois. I think the really sad, I use the word sad, that's not the right word, but the sad thing is that he's the kind of person who refuses to acknowledge any of Illinois' problems. He's trying to paint over them, you know, trying to confuse everybody, make everything sound good. Of course, he's running for re-election. But the reality is if you look at any data and his own data, you know, and that's what we used in the Wall Street Journal article. We used his own State Board of Education data, you know, the 2% reading results for third graders, black third graders in Decatur. That comes straight from the State Board of Education.
Right.
He says the data is wrong. Well, it's correct. All that data we used is his own data. So it just shows you what he's willing to do to get reelected.
And only 11% of Chicago public school black students can read at grade level. And
22.
But yet no one's held accountable for that failure.
Yeah, nobody's held accountable for that. And, you know, and what's fascinating is, you know, Pritzker made those comments on the debate with Bailey. And immediately after that, ISBE came out to defend Pritzker. ISBE says that, you know, the data's wrong. Well, it's again, their own data. The Herald Review, one of these newspapers, came out and says, Wall Street Journal mischaracterizes Decatur schools as failing. Well, what the hell do you call something that's got a 2% reading result? Or, you know, overall for the school, 9%. What do you call that? It's absolute failure.
ISBE suggests, though, Ted, right. You know, these data points are poor measures of student performance. And so my question is, well, if they're poor measures of students' performance, then why do you use them to measure students' performance?
Well, not only that, Dan, but they said you've got to look at the growth rates and how things are changing for the better. Well, if they're 2% in 2019, where were they before, if that's an improvement? I mean, it's all ludicrous. And I'll tell you, it goes even further than this. So Jordan Abudaya, which is Pritzker's spokeswoman,
yeah.
You know, this is how they're playing the games now. These are their tactics. When we put in there that 11% of blacks, third grade blacks in Chicago public schools were reading at grade level, she came back and said, I'm not going to read your garbage take if you're going to call those people blacks. Well, you know, geez, well, that's what the census calls black people, call them blacks. And that's what the State Board of Education calls the ethnicities in Chicago public schools, blacks.
You know, she wants you to call them African-American. I'm like, that is so, that's, no, people, they don't, my friend who's blacks, like, will you stop saying I'm African-American, I'm black?
Oh, just stop. Just stop with all this. This is, you know, I'm going to, you know, talk about your language. I'm going to talk about how you present facts because I can't deal with the underlying facts. I mean, this is so transparent. Exactly. Do people actually buy this flim-flammery? But apparently they believe they do. We're going to find out on November 8th, that's for sure.
Well, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, who they throw under the bus are the kids. And you know, think whatever you want about any of your politics. The facts on the ground are what we said they are, according to ISBE and according to the testing. They're horrendous across the board in so many places. And at the same time, things like teacher evaluations are at 100% for the proficient or excellent, 100% in schools like Decatur, like Chicago Public Schools.
100%.
And all of that is wrong. All of that is wrong. And until Pritzker or our leaders, I don't care who it is, start focusing on the data. Nobody's accountable, and we're making it.
Wait, oh yeah, all the men of and women of data, oh data, potato. All for years during the COVID, data, just following the data, where the data leads, data K-12, data fiscal health of the state. Hey,
data wrong.
Carnival barker, wrong. Carnival barker, attack the messenger.
Yeah, and so parents have to rise up in the end. You know, so it's always back to your original question from a few weeks ago. When does it get bad enough for people to rise up? Well, let's see.
Something interesting too about the whole K-12. I was looking at some of the data on spend and which school districts have what percentage of students in K through 12 in Illinois. I think interesting that's happened over the last two decades. CPS 20 years ago had 23% of the students statewide in K through 12, and they got 23% of the overall state spend on K through 12 education. Today, they have 17% of the total number of students in K through 12 statewide, and they still get 23% of the total spend on the total K through 12 spend from the state. So, you know, this is once you start looking at the average daily attendance numbers and the state spend, by the way, the state spend, the property tax spend, all of these things have gone up at a 45 degree angle while actual student enrollment in K through 12 in the state has gone down. Or maybe I can't remember. I think it's maybe slightly, maybe it's gone up a couple of points, but spend has gone up like 50-60%. And what are we getting for those results? And what is CPS doing? All the teachers are fine. Don't pay attention to the way that we measure student performance. The way we measure it is nothing to be addressed, and just keep sending us the money because we got to pay all the adults in the system, and we want to hire more wraparound services, so on and so forth. Continue to feed the union beast, which is what this is all about. But it's just interesting because if you start to look at the data, then what's actually happening and why it's happening comes into focus.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we actually look at the data, it would, and anybody cared about it, there'd be dramatic changes in how things happen. You know, these pensions continue to suck up a lot of the money. The other big thing is the amount of administrators have just ballooned in these schools. And, you know, teachers haven't grown that much. You know, like you said, student enrollment is either flat or down. And yet, when you look at the spending lines, they're hockey sticks. And it's particularly true in Chicago Public Schools, where 4 years ago, we spent $20,000 a student. This year we're spending $30,000 a student, almost $30,000. So it's you know, 40% up, and it's massive, and yet the results are disastrous, and again, nobody cares.
I want to go back to this this Pritzker hit on you guys too, and the data, and then one of the other criticisms, that's 2019 data. Well, I know that's exactly our point. It was pre-pandemic data. That was your point.
Now.
It's going to be worse, and then you actually looked at it in this response piece that you posted at WirePoint. The reading results in 2021, again, Illinois State Board of Education, reading proficiency, school districts, the number of school districts for reading proficiency is down 50 to 100%, 58 school districts, down 25 to 50%, 359 school districts. That's half the school districts in the state that have reading proficiency down 25 to 100%, 2019 numbers versus 2021 numbers. So, what do people say to that? Don't look at those numbers.
Well, they haven't said it. Yeah, well, we haven't published it yet, other than that one table. But we went through it. We've, you know, broken it all out, and it's fascinating how bad, you know, your 2 years where you cut out kids from being in the classroom, and you know, there's a big difference to which kids are cut out. But you know, it was just a collapse of results, and you even saw it in some of the best schools down. They might be at like 60% proficiency. The best schools are 70%, and they'll fall 10, 15, 20 points. And then you've got places like, you know, elementary schools where some of the kids were never in school, right? A third grader this year missed first and second grade. Well, they can't read. They don't know how to read. And so, you know, you see the results show up, and it's horrendous. We'll lay this out all in detail in the next couple of weeks, but, it's very damning and damaging. And this part Pritzker owns, it's all his stuff, his mitigations, his shutdowns, all that is his.
Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Oh, look, something else the FBI got wrong. What a surprise. It's newsworthy when they get something right these days. And particularly, errors are interesting. The errors are always in a one direction, sort of like when the D.C. press corps makes an error. It's always an error in advance of the left and to the detriment of the right. These random errors that occur that are always of one variety. John Lott, our friend over at the Crime Prevention Research Center, just did a study that he released. The percentage of shooting reports where civilians stop attacks. The FBI says it's rather small, thus the need for law enforcement, thus the need for restrictions on guns, probably, right? Because law-abiding gun owners don't stop violent attacks, and so this good guy with a gun is the remedy for bad guy with a gun narrative that doesn't work, according to some of those in law enforcement who are sympathetic to the gun banners. 4.4% is where the FBI has it. Civilians stop attacks using a gun in 4.4% of such incidents. John Lott says the correct number is more like 34%.
That's a big difference.
Off by a factor of 8, which is, standard issue. For more on this, John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, and the author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's great to talk to you guys again. Thanks.
So, explain how the FBI could be so wrong. What did they miss in their calculation?
Right. So what the FBI was looking at was something called active shooting events, cases where guns fired in public, no other crime involved like a robbery or a gang fight over drug turf. And they claim over the 8 years from 2014 to 2021 that there were 11 cases where there was this active shooting event where a civilian legally carrying a gun stopped an attack. What they did was police departments around the country don't collect this data. They hired some researchers at Texas State University, paid them, I guess, about $66.9 million over the last decade or so to do this and some other tasks, to go and collect news stories on it. And so we used the same definition, used the same method for collecting the data. And rather than 11 cases, we found at least 124. We don't have the millions of dollars, though, to go and search through this stuff. So I make no claim that the 124 is all of them. But people don't need to take our word for it. We have on our website at crimeresearch.org listed out all the cases, along with links to the underlying news stories so that people can go and check them out. But so there are a couple issues here. One is they're misclassifying some of the cases, five of the cases, but the other cases they missed. So the cases they misclassified are things like the shooting at the church near Fort Worth in December 2019, where there was a church, a man came in, fired his gun, and then one of the parishioners shot him, killing him. The FBI classifies that as a security guard stopping the attack. The person, I've talked to him while I was at the Department of Justice, and he said, he's no more a security guard than anybody else is. He's just, he was just a parishioner there at the church, who had permission from the minister. In fact, he said, look, there was probably like 18 to 20 people carrying that day at the church, parishioners. So the attacker really picked the wrong church to go to. And then there are other cases that they just miss. And so that's what we've listed out there.
Yeah, but why would they lie? I mean, why not just say it's a regular parishioner who's carrying? Because it's the truth.
I have to tell you, I was in the Department of Justice. One of my tasks was to go and look at their past reports. I pointed out these issues to them. they will acknowledge in writing that they have missed cases, but then they will not go and fix it. You know, it's one thing to make a mistake. It's one thing just to say, look, we didn't do a good job of catching all these things. You know, thanks. We'll add them in. But even when you nail them, even when they concede that they missed a case, they will have not gone back and fixed it.
So with your time there at DOJ and then interacting with the FBI, do you sense that they have a incentive or they're somehow motivated to minimize the number of incidents where civilians stop attacks by protecting themselves or others? Is there an agenda here?
Well, I can say in general, I dealt with the data people at the FBI on multiple different issues. And I'd worked in the federal government in the 1980s, but it's changed. And what's changed was there were two times when I would be arguing with people about other issues, and they would come back to me and say, well, I'm a Democrat, as a response to whether the data was right or not.
That is a response. So, the data has to comport to my views. That's what he's saying.
Basically, it's the way I interpreted what he was saying, because otherwise there was kind of no reason to go and bring up one's political affiliation in this. I mean, what was I supposed to do? Respond and say I'm a Republican, and that's how we debate whether the data is correct or not. Either the data is right or it's wrong. Uh-huh. And look, there are two other issues here. One is I'm more confident of the more recent data. And if you look at the data for 2021, I think the rate of stopping is about 48%, rather than 34%. And the other issue is one thing I tried to argue with the FBI when I was there is, look, if you want to look at the rate that civilians stop these attacks, you have to differentiate between gun-free zones where civilians are banned from being able to have guns for protection versus other ones where they're allowed. These are law-abiding citizens. If they're banned from carrying in certain areas, it's pretty unlikely that they're actually carrying in those areas, and so you can't expect them to go and stop those types of attacks. And when you do that, in 2021, for example, you're talking about something that's almost 60% of the time. So, you know, and I think that's a fairly reasonable. Otherwise, I use the exact same definition that they use. But I think that's a pretty reasonable distinction, whether or not they were legally able to go and carry a gun in a place. You can't expect them to stop attacks in places where they weren't allowed to carry. But I got no place in terms of arguing with them on that.
So another red letter day for the FBI on another issue. It doesn't stop with this agency. It's remarkable. But it is also noteworthy. This is happening. What you're talking about in terms of the recording of data. This is happening against the backdrop of this massive spike in violent crime we've seen across America, particularly in urban centers, since the government shutdowns, including in Chicago. And it doesn't seem to me like there's much appetite. I know there's been some overtures by Biden and some of these other gun banners about assault weapons, but they're not really spending that much time on it. Doesn't seem like with the lawlessness on the streets and with places like New York and Illinois releasing violent criminals back on the streets because of limited cash bail in New York or no cash bail coming to Illinois, there's just no appetite for telling me that I'm not going to be able to defend myself when you're telling me you're not going to protect me and showing me you're not going to protect me.
Yeah, look, we're in a weird world right now where many Democrats are making it difficult for law enforcement to do its job, law enforcement broadly. At the same time, they don't want to let individuals be able to go and defend themselves. There's just a court case in New Jersey where a man who had assisted the police had kind of served as carried a wire in order to record a conversation between some criminals. was being attacked by the criminals. He had been assaulted twice, beaten up twice, shot at, had moved his residence, and he hadn't been allowed to legally carry a concealed handgun. He was carrying. The police arrested him, and he was convicted for illegally carrying a gun. Finally, an appeals court said, you know, we're throwing out his conviction because he had a, you know, the police wouldn't say he had a good reason to be able to go and get a concealed carry permit, kind of get back to, you know, the old May issue type rules that were there. And the judge just came down pretty hard saying, look, you guys aren't able to protect him. What other option does he have other than be able to go and protect himself? But, you know, the political powers that be in New Jersey weren't going to let him do that. So, you know, we're in a weird world right now on this stuff. And Biden refuses to criticize the district attorneys across the country like Kim Fox. He refuses to go and criticize the liberal judges that have released in many urban areas, over half, and in some cases, two-thirds of the inmates from jails. He refuses to criticize the bail reform. I mean, just look at the case of a year ago in Wisconsin, where a man drove his SUV into the Christmas parade crowd, killing seven, wounding over 60 people that got sent to the hospital. That individual had already been arrested for an attempted murder of the mother of his child. He had faced three other felony charges. If you add up all the potential prison time he was facing, it was like 30 years. But he was released on $1,000 in bail, which basically meant he only had to put up $100 in order to be released. So he's 38. He's facing 30 years in jail. He's essentially facing a life sentence. What cost is it for him to go and murder somebody, or let alone seven people? What are you going to do, give him a second life sentence? So the first life sentence didn't deter him, but somehow a second or a third or a fourth or an eighth life sentence is going to be the final penalty that's going to deter him from committing more crimes.
He is John Law, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the DOJ's Office of Legal Policy, as we were discussing. Also the author of books, including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So I understand the little lady with the biggest dong in town was a no-show at the Italian-American Columbus Day Parade yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Columbus Day Parade. It wasn't just for Italian-Americans, of course, but featured and sponsored by the Joint Civic Committee for Italian-Americans or whatever they call themselves.
Yeah, she was apparently doing another event that was B-roll only, which means reporters do not dare ask a question. It's just video of her.
And Spalding, having a hamburger, no hot dog, french fries, no onion rings.
No, he was a no-show, and this is what his campaign put out. This Indigenous Peoples Day, the governor is honoring and celebrating the vast contributions of the Indigenous communities in Illinois and across the nation. He's unable to attend today's parade. Yeah. That was their response. It's almost unheard of. I've never seen it in my lifetime living here and growing up here that in an election year, a governor and a mayor both skip the Columbus Day Parade, and it didn't go without notice. Here's Ron Onesti, you know, Joint Civic Committee of Italian Americans.
The fact that the mayor and the governor are not here and several other governmental representatives, elected officials, you know, it really hurts us. It does. You know, we count on our elected officials to have the courage and bravery to stand up for what's right and stand up for the people.
And it was so strange.
You want them there?
If I was an Italian American, and there are 500,000, a half a million in the Chicago area, It's like a slap in the face that they didn't
Do you really want him there?
Yes.
Why?
I'm saying if I was an Italian Chicagoan, I would be appalled. Because he's not celebrating our day. He's celebrating Indigenous People's Day. He's making a choice.
You want to celebrate your day with J.B. Pritzker and Lori Lightfoot? Do you really?
Darren Bailey was there.
I think it's an absolute shame that Governor Pritzker and Lori Lightfoot choose to diminish the accomplishments that Italians have made to our society. So, no, I want to celebrate this. This is what America's about right here.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
A celebration of the willing. Yeah, so that's what it is. So, Ron and Esty, I mean, I like Ron, but you're upset that Lightfoot and Pritzker aren't there? No, you're not. Oh, because it's a sign of disrespect? Yeah, it is. So what else is new? So what are you going to do about it? What are all those rough and tumble Italian-Americans in West Central Cook County, including in public office, a lot of mayors, what are you going to do about it? What are the trades, Italian-Americans in the trades, firefighters, what are you going to do about it? The Italian-Americans in corporate America, in successful entrepreneurs, big honchos in the business community. So what? What are you going to do about it? I mean, you're happy to, many of you, not all, obviously, many of you are happy to be penis slapped by these two knuckleheads, aren't you? That's what it looks like to me. Am I wrong?
When are they going to get their statues back? That's what, you know, because last year they were able to have it for 20 minutes. Ooh, like a child custody case.
It's an open wound about the statues that still exists, and it continues.
And there's going to be a hearing soon, you know, over the lawsuit over the next few weeks to determine what's going to happen with that.
I'm sorry, I'm not, as usual, I'm not persuaded by the customary performative moral indignation we're supposed to have over this. Sorry, I took the hook out of my mouth a long time ago. Sorry. When was the Columbus taken down? Columbus statue taken
2020.
Down? 2020. Boy.
In August of 2020, after the whole summer of George Floyd, then they decided we're going after Columbus.
It's been a real revolution since 2020, hasn't it? I'm impressed.
Well, other political candidates were there. Maria Pappas, she was loud and proud.
Bring the statue back!
Bring it
Take
back!
Columbus, you discovered America!
She's always like, Christopher Columbus, he discovered America. Woo! I know it's like a big soap opera, but I couldn't, like, seeing what politicians were there and which ones weren't was, I don't know, I would just be so offended if I were.
Oh, of course, because that's what you're supposed to be. Because you know how we get our validation in Illinois? From politicians. Is that right? Gosh, I don't feel like I'm self-actualized. I don't feel important unless one of these despicable, grotesque politicians shows up to my little party. The disrespect that should anger you is not their patting you on the head by showing up to your little party. It should be what they've done to this state and your prospects for staying and the future for your families. But no, let's make it about a statue and my party, because we're infants. And then we wonder why we're treated like that. Same thing with the Chicago Tribune. I mean, their editorial, their endorsement in the governor's race is out. Golly gee, I wonder which way they went.
Who did they choose, Dan?
Here's the thing about this, though, too. I mean, first of all, this is like an editorial board comprised of, like, theater critics. So, I mean, what do you expect?
Yeah, because everyone who, you know, had a fight in the game, Kristen McQuarrie, John Cass, they're gone.
We noted a certain ruthless political tinge to some of his actions, J.B. Pritzker, the man they endorsed on the campaign trail, including a refusal to meet with us. He complained of consistently unfair treatment, the Tribune reported, which is absurd. Oh, but he doesn't have to show up. He doesn't have to show up and dignify your presence. You're happy to fall in line.
You endorsed him anyway.
The editorial board of theater critics at the Chicago Tribune. Yeah. Oh, that was absurd what he did. We endorse him. He did such a wonderful job. And they're going to tell you, what would they say in response to that? Chris, hey. Yes, he treated us disrespectfully, Dan, but we rise above because our perspective, our outlook is about what's best for Illinois and best for Chicago. Oh, clearly.
When they go low, we go high.
Yeah, that's basically that, what Michelle you'd get. Obama. That's basically what you'd get. There are just people and institutions in this city and state that cannot be defiled enough and quickly enough by those they elevate. And this is why Pritzker can get away, as we were talking with Ted Dabrowski about it last hour. This is why he can get away with the bond rating upgrades to Illinois' bond rating, since we have the worst bond rating of any state in the nation. Our fiscal health, our economic outlook has not changed an iota. In fact, it's deteriorated under this governor, as you pay higher taxes to finance the deterioration. He didn't come to my party. He took my statue. What are you going to do about it? Oh, you're going to have a status hearing 2 years later? Wow. You're showing him. I appreciate people that are putting in something approximating a fight, but I mean, come on. Come on.
Well, the wheels of justice churn slowly.
Had nothing to do with that. The location of people's political courage is what happens at a glacial pace in this state. And that's the issue here. Spare me. Spare me that any of these people bitching are leading a revolt or holding their brethren to account. He doubled the gas tax and threw some money at infrastructure. So he's my guy. He's your guy. He couldn't find you more detestable. You couldn't have less in common with him. He could not care less about you or your future. You're a way station for him as he tries to become a real boy someday by running for president.
The Tribune editorial, they said, even among those who did not support him politically, he engendered trust during some of the darkest hours in the history of this great state.
Yeah, right.
That's so, during COVID.
Right. So please. So the really? Propping up acceptable lies from the acceptable liar that they've selected. What is new about this? Find some self-respect. Stand up for yourself. Acceptable lies and the acceptable liars. I mean, the men in particular, I said this before, I'll say it again.
So please.
Italian men who like to think of themselves, as all men do, as, you know, macho and tough and stand-up guy. I'm not getting pushed around.
Protecting my woman and my family.
I'm not getting pushed around. You're begging. Please like me. You're Jeb Bush. Please clap. Please clap for the Columbus Parade. Please clap for my trade union. Please clap. Please give me something. Please like me. What kind of man? Would you affiliate with a man who tried to commit a tax fraud that you would pay for if the fraud were successful, and then he hides behind his wife? He throws his wife under the bus. That's what J.B. Pritzker did when he ripped out the toilets from his mansion. It's exactly what he did. Anybody who countenances that is as pathetic as he is, especially any man. Put your pee hat on, you male impersonator. Well, and Darren Bailey, whatever you want to think about Darren Bailey and the downstate farmer, Darren Bailey at least is a man who honors his wife, who farms with his family, who serves his school district, local school district, who started a Christian school with his wife. I mean, at least he is a adult male.
Well, and Pritzker not only not showing up, releasing this statement through his campaign advisor, hiding yesterday. Hiding again today. No events posted.
Well, of course.
He wants us to go away, and then something else will happen, and the reporters won't remember to ask, why didn't you go to the Columbus Day Parade?
Eunuchs for Pritzker, right? I mean, he's a eunuch, and so are you. Any man that would support him.
He doesn't have any male on his staff.
I'd love for any man, male supporter Pritzker, to call in and tell me otherwise. But you're, you know, too much of a pee hat to do that, aren't you?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Matt, Oak Lawn.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. It's taken a long time, but the The 5'7" men that wear horns on their necks have finally bested the Irish in this city. They kept those losers from their parade.
All right. Thanks for the call, Matt. Jay, South Loop.
Hey, how you doing this morning? You guys are spot on. These guys are cowards. And, you know, the irony is, you know, here they're talking about all the indigenous, how we need to honor the indigenous rights and everything. And then what do? They turn around and rename Lakeshore Drive after DuSable, who really was probably, in today's terms, was probably the biggest gentrifier of all in how he behaved. And, you know, they use that to rename the Lakeshore Drive after him, which is just, you know, it's just ironic how these guys do this stuff.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jay.
I don't like the renaming of any. It's Lakeshore Drive, LSD, in our household, and it will always be that way.
Come on, where are the Johnny Punch clocks? The Italian Americans who work as firefighters and electricians and operating engineers and plumbers, as well as those C-suiters who are still, you know, take ethnic pride and pride in their work ethic and their family's ancestry, built a life for them, their family in this country, you know, that came here the turn of the century or all the way really to probably mid-century, right? This is who you came. This is who your parents sacrificed for to elevate this trust fund buffoon and balloon.
He missed a chance to wear a sash at a parade, Dan.
I love it. I love it. I love all the rough and tumble. City that works hard and plays hard. I love all the phony, rough and tumble dudes around here. And you know who they are. And I know who you are. And you're frauds. You support this guy, you're a fraud. Turn in your man card. Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Yes, I'm Italian. First, the Democrat Party and Pritzker disrespected me as a man, an Illinois worker, a voter, and an Italian. I don't want Pritzker nowhere near me. And I have Italian friends and relatives that vote for this creep. They should be ashamed of themselves. You're right. Take away their woman card, their man card, or their Italian card. He's a creep, and Bailey's a man. And he could come, and I'll shake his hand anytime. But Pritzker and the Democratic Party, as an Italian and as a worker, could stay away from me. And I could say a lot more words, but I'm on the radio, and I don't want to be cut off. So thank you for your time.
Well, don't forget to tell your relatives what he did.
Thanks for the call, Vince.
Your Democratic relatives.
Dave and Niles.
This is Tim. It's not in Niles.
Oh, I don't know. Okay.
Well, hello.
Sorry, I'm going by my call screener, Tim, and from wherever you are. Okay.
From wherever I am. You know, ignorance is an excuse for some things. Apathy is not. And, you know, the Democrats win coming and going when it comes to people that are ignorant. And then also once they learn, they're just tired of it. And they don't want to do anything about it. So I think you're spot on in a lot of the things you say, but what is the Republican Party doing to reach out to those people? That's really the number one issue on my mind. That's
well,
all I got to say.
I thanks for the call. I mean, it's fair. That's a fair point to raise. What can you do other than present all of the facts and make the arguments about substantive public policies that impact people's lives, their personal safety and their economic security? So the Safety Act, for example. The general lawlessness in the city of Chicago, even prior to, well, effectively prior to the Safety Act, because it hasn't taken effect yet, but that's the paradigm under which Kim Fox and Tim Evans and Tony Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot and Tom Dart are operating. The economic security issue, where Illinois stands, what we've done, why businesses are leaving, what it means when Pritzker and Lightfoot's look at Citadel and Boeing and Caterpillar and Tyson Foods walk out the door and say, oh, no big deal. The quality of the schools at the ever-increasing price point, the value of your houses with the ever-increasing property tax. I mean, all you can do is say, here's what you're paying, as if you didn't know. Here's what you're getting. Does that look like a good value to you? Here's the quality of the schools. Does that look like a place you want to send your kids? Here's the job market. Does this look like a place you want to stay? Almost 15% on black unemployment in the city of Chicago. I mean, I don't know what appeal you make other than these are the people in charge. They've been in charge forever. The names have changed. The policies have not. This is the result. If you want to continue to support them because you don't like Trump, this is the latest boogeyman, and the other boogeymans they've used before, or you think everyone who disagrees with the people in charge are racist or something, or insurrectionists, well, that, I mean, you know, you can't stop people from believing things that aren't true. All you can do is present what I've presented and what I've described here and what other people are presenting on the campaign trail. And people have to make up their minds. I mean, you know, if you're committed to running, screaming off a cliff, there's only so much anyone can do. We're going to see. But you cannot say the overtures haven't been made, because they've been made. They're being made nationally, which is why, for example, the spread among Latino voters is declining so fast. And they're being made, the overtures are being made to black voters. The overtures are being made to the trades. A little bit of carrot and stick, at least my rhetoric. I concede the point, but I think that's what's required. Rich in Indian Head Park. Hey, Rich.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I agree with you 100%. This has nothing to do with respect towards Italian Americans. What we have to do is we have to vote this guy out of office because of the policies that he has and how he doesn't protect the cities and he doesn't protect anybody in the state. He's all for himself. As long as he's the governor, that's all that counts.
Thanks, Rich.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.